stuff that went wrong.
Yes, well, I was actually at a point which is probably not absolutely important. I was, I just wanted to know whether all of you are familiar with the Abhidharmic analysis, how we arrive at the 18 dhatu. I'm sure the members of the Sangha here will know that, but maybe some of the lay people may not be aware of that. Well, it may be, there may be a lot to write if you have to write it. Yes, yes. The skanda at this point we have already dealt with. We are now, I want now to refer to the dhatu and ayatana. So I just want very briefly to review for the benefit of those of you who may not have studied this, that in Buddhism we arrive at these 18 elements through an analysis of the processes of experience, through the analysis of the processes of perception. So in every case of experience, we have three elements. We have the sense organ, we have the object, and we have the mind, the consciousness that is aware of this experience. So for example, in the case of the sense of vision, we have the faculty of vision, we have the eyes, we have the visible object, and we have the mind consciousness, visual mind consciousness, the consciousness awareness of the object. So here we have three elements, right? We have three elements. We have the sense of vision, we have the object of vision, the flower, the tree, the building, the person, whatever it may be, the object of vision, and then we have the consciousness of the object. Now, if any of these three are missing, we don't have experience, right? If our eyes are closed, we won't see the tree, and we won't be conscious of the tree. If there's no tree, we won't see the tree, and we won't be conscious of the tree. If our eyes are open, and the tree is in front of us, but our minds are elsewhere, our minds are distracted, we won't see the tree. So we need to have the combination of these three elements to have visual consciousness. And the same is true in regard to the remaining five faculties. In Buddhism, the mind is also a faculty, so we need the mind, we need a thought, a dharma, an idea, and we need mind consciousness. We need the mind to be conscious of this idea. So in each of these cases, whether it's visual, whether it's auditory, whether it's to do with the nose, with olfactory perception, the sense of smell, and so forth, in all six of these cases, we have three elements. The mind, the organ, the sense organ, and the sense object. So these are the 18 dhatu. These are the 18 elements of experience according to the Abhidharma analysis. The sense media or the six ayatana refer to the sphere, to the conjunction of the sense organs and the sense objects. So these are the, it's three times six. Three elements, six sense organs, six sense spheres, three elements, three times six, 18, 18 dhatus. All of these dhatus are declared by the sutra to be empty, not to exist in emptiness. So this is the main body of the text. A good portion of the text, good portion of the sutra is occupied with the declaration that this is how a son or daughter of good family is to follow, is to practice in the perfection of wisdom, by understanding that form is emptiness and emptiness is form. form is not different from emptiness, emptiness is not different from form, and that in emptiness there is no eye, no ear, no nose, none of these sense faculties exist, that there is no object, no form, no sound, no smell, and that there is no eye consciousness, no ear consciousness, all the way up to no mind consciousness. So the five aggregates are all empty, not different from emptiness, and in emptiness none of these 18 elements, which are the result of the Abhidharmic analysis of experience, none of these 18 elements exist in emptiness. This is the first and the most, in some ways, the most direct message of the sutta, is to declare the emptiness of these Abhidharmic categories, of the elements that are identified by the Abhidharmic analysis. So you can see there's a very close relationship here between the Abhidharma and the Heart Sutra, much as you might think this is strange, but actually, you know, the relationship between position and counterposition, the relationship between thesis and antithesis, is a very close relationship. This is what the persons who, you know, this is what the perfection of wisdom is concerned with, overthrowing the realistic conception, the Abhidharmic conception, the Abhidharmic analysis as conceived of realistically, as conceived of as insofar as it leaves us with real elements, real factors, and to declare that these real factors are empty, which means effectively that they're insubstantial, that they're dependent upon other factors. Now, at this point, I want to examine a little bit for a moment the idea of emptiness, the concept of emptiness, the doctrine of emptiness. What is this emptiness? What is emptiness? Well, you're actually quite close there. You're actually pretty close to the right answer. Certainly there's a very close relationship between impermanence and emptiness. And this has been declared by Mahayana masters who say, for example, there was an argument sometime in the Middle Ages about whether the arhats understood emptiness. And one of the great Mahayana masters, Chandrakirti, argued very emphatically that indeed the arhats do, the shravakas, the arhats do understand emptiness, because their understanding of impermanence implies their understanding of emptiness. And we also learn in the Mahayana / Vajrayana tradition, we are also taught, we're told that impermanence is the key to understanding emptiness. By understanding impermanence, we can achieve an understanding of emptiness. So certainly, emptiness is very closely related to impermanence. But let's concentrate first on what emptiness is not. And one thing that it's not is, it's not a thing, it's not an entity, and it's not a metaphysical principle. Emptiness is just another name for interdependent origination, and emptiness is also identical with the middle way. And why do we say this? Because emptiness teaches that reality is beyond existence and non-existence. We return to our old friends, existence and non-existence, about which the Buddha talked to Kacayana, the views of existence and non-existence. Emptiness is identical with interdependent origination, and emptiness is identical with the middle way. At one point, Nagarjuna declares that emptiness, interdependent origination, and the middle way are identical in meaning. And they're identical in meaning because what emptiness teaches is that things are neither existent nor non-existent. And this is exactly what the Buddha tells Kacayana in the Kacayana Gotra Sutta. The Buddha tells Kacayana, the world originates, the world appears, we experience the world, right? I mean, if I hit this table hard enough, it's going to hurt. The world is here, we experience it. From that fact, nobody can maintain non-existence. Can't say the world doesn't exist. Of course it exists. I mean, everywhere you look, we experience the world. It exists. It's there. It's in front of you. It's in your face, as they would say nowadays. The world is there. So you can't say the world doesn't exist. But also, from the fact that the world disappears, that this table is going to disappear one day, that I'm going to disappear, that we're all going to cease to be, that we're all impermanent, absolutely correct, that all of this is going to disappear. From that fact, we cannot say that the world exists also, because it doesn't exist in any substantial, permanent manner. It exists in the manner of something seen in a dream. It exists in the manner of an illusion. It exists in a provisional manner, like dream. So it is beyond existence and non-existence. You can't say of something seen in a dream also, you can't say that it's non-existent because you saw it, you experienced it. But you can't say also that it exists because when you wake up, it's no longer there. So it isn't truly existent also. So the point is, emptiness, a lot of people have difficulties with emptiness. A lot of people have misinterpreted emptiness. Emptiness is also one of those terms. Shunyata has been translated emptiness in Western translations, in English translations. And it's been translated emptiness with such consistency, so commonly, that we are now, for practical purposes, we're stuck with it. In many cases, I would prefer, and I do in fact use relativity as a translation for emptiness. Because emptiness doesn't mean nothingness. It really means relativity. Emptiness is a very multifaceted, a very rich term in Sanskrit and in Indian linguistics. Even here in Thailand, as in India, shunya is zero. In Thai, sun is zero. Now you would say, well, zero, what is zero? Zero is just zero. Not so, because without zero we wouldn't have 10. Without zero we wouldn't have 100, we wouldn't have 1,000. Zero is a very, very important number. It's not just zero. Zero is also multiple. It's responsible for the capacity to multiply. Otherwise, if it weren't for zero, we'd all be stuck at 9. We wouldn't be able to get beyond 9. You have to say 2 times 9, 3 times 9. It would be very complicated. Zero is very useful. The term shunya in Sanskrit also means swollen. It has also the sense of being pregnant, being full, like a bubble, like a balloon. So shunya has got this kind of ambiguity in the original term. It has an ambiguity of meaning, which is certainly not nothingness. But let's put that aside for a moment. Shunyata is not something to be held on to. It's not a view. Look at, remind you again of the parable of the raft. This applies also to shunyata. Shunyata is not something to be held on to. It's not something to be a view. Not something to be taken as a view, as a dogma. Nagarjuna says, shunyata is the end of all views. As far as those who grasp shunyata as a view, they are hopeless. So what is shunyata? Shunyata is a relative provisional designation. It's a pedagogical teaching device. It's a term that is used in order to describe the interdependence of things, the insubstantiality of things, the fact that things are mutually dependent. It's used as a teaching device, as a pedagogical device, as a provisional predication, as a provisional term designating the interdependence of things. That's why in one of the commentaries to the Mahayana Sutras, there is a list of 16 types of emptiness. And one of the 16 types of emptiness is the emptiness of emptiness. So emptiness is also empty. Emptiness is also insubstantial. Nagarjuna says, and try to follow this closely, this is a little bit tricky. Nagarjuna says, if there was something non-empty, then there might be something empty. But since there's nothing non-empty, how can there be something empty? This is almost like a Zen koan. But what it means is that emptiness only has a meaning if there was something that had substance. If there was something that really existed, then you could talk about something being empty. But since there's nothing that really has self-existence, nothing that has swabhava, so there's nothing that has niswabhava. It's relative. It's the relativity of emptiness and non-emptiness. The relativity of existence and non-existence. You know, think about it for a moment. Just do a little mental exercise. If you think of existence, can you think of existence without thinking of non-existence? Try to think about just existence for a while. Can you do it? Yeah? You can think about existence without thinking about non-existence. No, well, what is existence then? Tell me, what is it? Define existence for me without reference to non-existence. They're interrelated. No, you can't. You can't separate them. What about tall and short? You know, how can you think about tall without thinking about short? You say, oh, he's tall. Tall? In relation to whom? In relation to who is that fellow who plays for the Dallas Mavericks or whatever that basketball team is? Yao? Yeah. I mean, what? He's tall. What? He's tall in relation... Who is he? You can say, someone is short, you know? Or sometimes people say, I'm tall in relation to him. In relation to him, I'm short. You know, these are relative terms. Far and near. Now, when I first went to live in Singapore, I was given a government flat in Jurong East. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Singapore geography. Singapore, you know, I think it's 45 kilometers long, something like that. And I was given a flat in Jurong East, and my office was in the center of town, and everybody said, oh, your office, your house is so far from your office. You know, I know people who live in the Midwest, in the United States, or in Canada, who will drive 4 hours to eat at an Indian restaurant. For them, that's not far. For Singaporeans, if you have to drive 20 minutes to get home, it's far. You know, so near and far, short and long, existence and non-existence, all of these things are relative. They only have meaning in relation to each other. So shunyata only has meaning in relation to svabhava. It only has meaning in relation to the idea of substantial existence. And what is the purpose of shunyata? What is the purpose of emptiness? The purpose of emptiness is to act as a corrective, to act as an antidote to the belief in the real independent existence of things, the real independent existence of factors. That's what shunyata is for. Shunyata is just a medicine. It's just a corrective for that mistaken belief in the real existence of entities. Shunyata is nothing in itself. When the mistaken belief in the real independent existence of entities, when that is overcome, when that is gotten over with, then you no longer need shunyata. Shunyata is just an antidote, it's just a corrective. Its only purpose is to neutralize the poison of believing in the real independent existence of things. So that's why we say shunyata is like a medicine. When you get over the illness, and again here you can recall the example of the raft, but in this case let's take the example of medicine. When you get over the illness, you don't keep on taking the medicine. You know, if you have a fever and you go to the doctor and he gives you an antibiotic and he says take this for a week, and then you take it for a week and you get over the fever and you think this medicine is very good, I don't have a fever anymore, so you go on taking the medicine? No, you stop taking the medicine because the disease is cured. You don't need the medicine anymore. And similarly, shunyata is not something to be held on to. It's not something to be clung to. We also say shunyata is like salt. How is it like salt? It's like salt in the sense that you put a little bit of salt in your food tastes very nice. It makes your food more appetizing, more palatable. You take a spoon of salt by itself and eat it, it's terrible. You can't eat salt by itself. You can't eat only salt. A little pinch of salt in all your food is fine. Salt by itself is terrible. The same way with shunyata. Little pinch of shunyata in everything, everything goes fine. It works. Everything works. Take shunyata by itself, you're looking for trouble. It's going to be unpalatable. It's going to be indigestible. So shunyata has to be used with wisdom. It has to be used with prudence. You have to understand what the purpose of shunyata is. What do we mean by emptiness? What is this emptiness? Everybody talks about emptiness, emptiness. What is emptiness? Emptiness is just another term for the interdependence of things, for the insubstantiality of entities. That's what shunyata is about. That's what shunyata means. Shunyata is not something to be held onto. It's not some kind of prize. It's not some sort of precious jewel, something that you grasp, something that you hold on to. It's just a teaching device. It's just a way to help us get over attachment to the existence of independent things, to the belief in the existence of independent things, of things being independent. Now, of course, I'll go on to. I hope at this point I have perhaps alleviated. I hope I have calmed the fears of some of you with regard to shunyata. It's not so terrible. It's not so frightening. Of course, I mean, it can be frightening. It can be frightening for people who like to hold on to things. I mean, you tell people to let go of the raft. Some people say, no, don't take my raft away. I need my raft. But you're on dry land now, you've crossed the water. No, but I need my raft. I have to hold on to my raft. So yes, some people are frightened by shunyata. It has some quite dramatic consequences, shunyata, relativity. Let's use this term. Relativity is a nice term, no? Isn't it? I mean, it sounds nice and scientific and modern. We can use the term relativity. Relativity is something that has quite serious consequences for some fundamental Buddhist notions, some quite fundamental Buddhist dualities. May I say Buddhist dualities? Am I being heretical? What about samsara and nirvana? What effect does emptiness have on samsara and nirvana? It's pretty devastating. The effect is pretty dramatic. Because emptiness means that there's no real difference between samsara and nirvana. The non-differentiation of samsara and nirvana, the identity of samsara and nirvana, is one of the consequences of emptiness. Now I'm sure some of you are getting a little bit worried. Now what are we going to do if we don't have samsara and nirvana? Then where are we? What's going to happen? But of course samsara and nirvana are not real. They're interdependent. How can you think of nirvana without samsara? Nirvana? What is nirvana? Nirvana is the opposite of samsara. Samsara is the opposite of nirvana. You can't think of one without thinking of the other. They depend on each other. If you eliminate samsara, you eliminate nirvana. There's no more nirvana. You can't have nirvana without samsara. As long as you have nirvana, you're going to have samsara also, because they're interdependent. So emptiness means beyond all extremes, beyond all dualities, beyond all alternatives. Samsara and nirvana, according to the Prajnaparamita, according to the Mahayana tradition, samsara and nirvana are the products of mind. The distinction between samsara and nirvana is a subjective distinction. Samsara is reality seen from the point of view of a defiled mind, of an afflicted mind. Nirvana is reality seen from the point of view of a purified mind. There's no difference in the reality. The reality is there, it's tatata, suchness. It's just that, thatness. It's neither this nor that, it's just there. It's the mind that creates samsara, the mind that creates nirvana. It's a subjective distinction, it's a distinction created by mind. And it's also true that the distinction between samskrita dharmas, which are the conditioned factors, and asamskrita dharmas, these are also avidharmic categories. Conditioned mind, conditioned factors are what make up the world. Nirvana is one of the unconditioned factors. But the conditioned factors don't really exist. Why? Because what are the characteristics of condition factors? The characteristics of condition factors are origination, duration, and destruction. But in emptiness, there's no origination. What is there to originate? There's no duration, there's no destruction. And we will investigate this in more detail when we look at the teaching and the works of Nagarjuna and the Madhyamaka school in the next half, the second half of this course in January. But the fact is, we can understand this by means of the analogy of dream. In one of the other Prajnaparamita sutras, it's not called the Prajnaparamita sutra, but it does teach emptiness, the Samadhi Raja Sutra. The Samadhi Raja Sutra, there's a famous analogy about the dream of a virgin girl. So a virgin girl has a dream. In that dream, she gives birth to a son, and still in that dream, the son dies. And so when the son is born, she's overjoyed. When the son dies, she's distraught. But then when she awakens from the dream, she realizes that the son was never really born and never really died. And similarly, all things are never really born and never really perish. Why? Because they don't exist in reality. Their existence is like the existence of objects in a dream. You know, when you talk about one of the favorite examples of the Prajnaparamita literature and of the Mahayana in general is the example of magical illusion. And what it says basically is that those people who are foolish may be taken in by a magical illusion, but those people that are wise, they're not excited when they see a magical show, and they're not upset when the magically created person or elephant or whatever it may be disappears. And nowadays, a lot of people think, well, this example isn't worth very much. After all, we don't believe in magic anymore. All right. Well, what about holograms? What do you think of holograms? I mean, a hologram can project a three-dimensional image of an apple. You can walk all around that apple. You can see that apple from every side. If you reach out to take the apple, it's not there. That's a pretty good magical show. And it's a pretty good example of emptiness and how all things are empty. We are used to a lot of illusions and we understand them. We're not taken in by them. When there were some primitive tribes that were first shown television sets, they were first introduced to television. And the tribes, naturally, the people of these primitive tribes who'd never encountered televisions before, they were astonished. And their reaction was, how did they get all those little people into this box? And of course, that's a perfectly natural reaction for someone who doesn't know how television works. We know how television works, so we're not, you know, we're not worried about it. When the little people in the television set, when they die, when they shoot each other and so forth, we don't get too upset about it. Because we know it's just an image, just a magical show. I know some people still cry at the movies, but in general, people are not taken in by these magical shows. And similarly, if we can understand, if we understand the whole world like a magical show, then we won't be attached. We won't be attached to things. We won't grasp things. We won't be upset when things disappear, when things fall apart. And everything is like a magical show because everything originates, everything exists dependent on causes and conditions. You won't get the image in the television set without the hardware, without the television set, without the transmission, without the station, without the electricity. It all depends on causes and conditions. And it all disappears when the power goes, when the television breaks, when the television station shuts down for the night, it all disappears. Because it's all a product of causes and conditions. And we're all products of causes and conditions. We're all here because of causes and conditions. We're not here by our own right. We don't have any certificate of substantiality. Show me your certificate of substantiality. Are you really here? Am I really here? I'm here because of causes and conditions. And when those causes and conditions change, I won't be here. I might be in Chiang Mai. I might be untraceable. You know, who knows? Because our existence, all of our existence, is provisional. It's like the existence of people and things in a dream. It's not permanent, not substantial. It's provisional. It's just an appearance. like a dream, like a mirage, and so on. The sutra has more to say about some of the fundamental teachings of Buddhism, the duality between ignorance and the destruction of ignorance and so forth. I think I've covered quite a lot this afternoon. There are a few minutes left. Maybe I'll just stop at this point and invite questions, and then we can begin again tomorrow with the remaining part of the sutra. Are there any questions? I think everyone is in a state of shock. Well, I mean, you know, this is not unusual. I mean, this is natural. This is normal. All right, then yeah, please. Sure.
Just now you were saying that to know the Mahayana well or Hinayana well, you need to know Abhidharma.
Yes.
But I believe, like the Theravada tradition, the Abhidharma is considered as a more of a commentary than Sutta itself.
Well, I think so, because even though there is a debate within the Theravada tradition about the nature of the Abhidharma, and I think in general there are a lot of people who would say, and I'm also among those people who would say, that Abhidharma is not the word for word teaching of the Buddha, that the Abhidharma was composed by disciples, that it was compiled by disciples or written by disciples, and that it's not the word of the Buddha. But by the same token, we also do believe that it was inspired by the Buddha, and that the Buddha had that the Buddha also did deliver discourses that are quite Abhidharmic in character. No, the Abhidharma is very important because in the Theravada tradition it has been traditionally recommended for teachers of the Dharma. Those who want to teach the Dharma, who would like to teach the Dharma, should be familiar with the Abhidharma. Even the word Abhidharma can be, and usually is, translated as higher Dharma or about the Dharma. And although it's true that it's not the sutta, but rather it is a kind of analysis of the sutta, but the comparison, the example that's often given, is that the sutta is like the medicine in the bottle, and the Abhidharma is like the label. So if you don't have the label and you only have the medicine, then you won't be able to use the medicine so effectively. So for this reason, it's important to know the Abhidharma. I'm saying the Abhidharma is important because it's a framework which appears and reappears in all the Buddhist traditions, not only in the Theravada tradition, but as I said, in the Mahayana tradition, and even in the Vajrayana tradition, which may surprise you, but in the Vajrayana tradition, the Abhidhamma categories are very important in the whole Vajrayana conception of the personality and the whole Vajrayana conception of the scheme of the chakras and so on and so forth. Abhidhamma is absolutely central. The deities that inhabit the body and so forth are all related to Abhidhamma categories and classifications. So I'm saying that the Abhidhamma is important even though it may not be the actual words of the Buddha, but it is a very good guide to help you. It's kind of like a reference book or a kind of roadmap to various Buddhist traditions, whether it be Zen or Chan and Zen, or whether it be Vajrayana, whether it be Mahayana. With the knowledge of the Abhidhamma, you will find your way around these texts and these teachings much more easily. And I know that the problem is that a lot of people find the Abhidhamma boring. And the problem is not really with the Abhidhamma. The problem is that people don't understand the Abhidhamma, they think the Abhidhamma is theoretical. Actually, it's not theoretical. The Abhidhamma is the product of meditative experience. Abhidhamma are kind of notes from meditative experience. I mean, that's the best way I can describe Abhidhamma. Unfortunately, it is taught in a very pedantic way, I must admit. I mean, nowadays, most of the books, there are some good books. I mean, Jnanaponika, for example, his books on Abhidhamma are very good. And there are a couple of other people who have written quite lucidly about Abhidhamma. A lot of the manuals are quite dense, I admit. But it's worth making the effort. Well, I mean, it is considered one of the baskets, but then again, there was the debate about that at the Fourth Council, where the Sutrantikas did not accept the Abhidhamma as the word of the Buddha, as part of the canon, because of exactly what you said, that it's commentarial rather than being a sutra. And of course, the Mahayanists made hay. They took advantage of this, because whenever the Theravadins said, "We don't accept your Mahayana scriptures," the Mahayanists said, "Well, so what? You don't agree about your own scriptures, because there are some of you who don't accept the Abhidharma." So, yes, there has been a debate about that, but of course, traditionally, we do find the Abhidharma included in the Tripitaka. It's one of the three baskets, yes. Okay, well then, just remember to put a pinch of emptiness into everything that you do, and we'll see you tomorrow morning. If we don't all disappear by then.